This is the final closing interview with Jesse Haver Butler on May 16, 1973. The interview essentially was to pick up some material, especially related to her involvement with the Fabian Summer School, and to have her describe her recent interest and involvement in the child care center question. However, I took this opportunity to also explore some material to use in the health series related to her experience of the miscarriage in England, her experiences with the later childbirths in the mother's clinics in London. This resulted in a very lengthy discussion about the art of breastfeeding, the way the hospitals are set up for childbirth, and then a discussion of the depression after the birth of her daughter and her entry into 4 years of Jungian analysis. Some of the material is a little bit bizarre, both on the tape but primarily off tape, which blurs fantasy, reality, and dreams. This is evident when she talks about her father's mother and begins to talk about her in the first person. When the blurring occurs, it is quite obvious, and it is a sign of her mystical beliefs rather than any sort of impairment of thinking. I have previously encountered much of this in discussions with her when she begins to tell me about the dream interpretations and discusses reincarnation and some of her other spiritual, mystical beliefs.
Ask you about what I want to go into some things about childbirth and menstruation and birth control that we touched upon here and there, but I want to get a better idea. First, you mentioned you mentioned in the very beginning, I don't know if it was your father's mother who took to bed after she had 9 children. Was that who it was? Could you tell me that more about that story?
I certainly can. Get rid of this pill here. Now, I want to tell you something funny. I was his mother. And I have had hundreds of dreams about what was the matter with me. I can give you a vivid description of it. And the house that they lived in, they had a big old house. And this woman was not a, I wasn't either. In my just previous life, I was a man in the first place. And then, of course, there was no birth control deal, you see. So I kept having these beautiful boys. There were just 7 boys, handsomest men you ever saw. But that big house got dirtier and dirtier. And of course, in those days, in the pioneer days, they didn't have any conveniences. And I have had hundreds of dreams about that house
now,
and how helpless
I
was. It was in Ohio. It was in, originally, let me see now. Later they moved to LaSalle, Illinois. But their first home was in Ohio. And my father's father was a deacon in the Congregational Church and an intellectual man. He had the first library in that town and the first library in LaSalle, Illinois. And he was also a carpenter, and he made what do you call a man who makes furniture?
A cabinet maker?
Yeah, he was cabinet maker and did all the coffins of the town as well. See, it was cabinet maker and a very intelligent, as a matter of fact, my teacher was telling me the other day that I came from what do you call a horse that's a racehorse, a hybrid?
A thoroughbred.
Mm-hmm. She said that children that came from thoroughbred families She said she believed in that thoroughbred. Well, I said, you don't put a thoroughbred racehorse in with ranch horses if you want to breed thoroughbred racehorses, do you? And she said, that's it. So evidently, as far as culture went in those days, this grandfather had it.
Mm.
Being a deacon in the congregational church. Is my breath and voice all right now? And having a library and being a cabinet maker. And he had a great big house, and in the basement was an enormous cellar. And there they stacked in the summer great barrels of apples and potatoes the way the people did in those years, so that through the year they'd have food to eat, you see. But that kitchen, I have dreamed of that kitchen so many times, was just nauseating. It was so filthy. And I couldn't cope with it. And then I kept having all these babies, and probably there were no midwives around. That word midwife always missing me. So undoubtedly, my body was torn to bits, you see. And so at the end of the ninth child, I just went to bed and never got up again.
Now, had she had miscarriages before then?
No, as far as I could see, none.
Uh-huh.
And she just could not take it anymore. And they never could find out anything was wrong with her.
Did she in no way indicated what was wrong?
No, she just said she couldn't, she was ill, and she was going to bed, and she stayed there. There were two girls out of the nine children, and one died, and the other girl, my Aunt Carrie, then was just growing up, took care of that family and that bedridden woman.
Now, how common was that, do you think, a woman, since there was no birth control, just ending up going to bed so that she didn't have to have more children?
What's your question?
Do you think that was very common?
No. I think that, in the first place, the fact I'd been a man before meant that I had the courage to make decisions and live up to them, which women those days, they just took it and died. You know, mm-hmm. The babies just came. And no, I never heard of such a thing. Nor did they ever hear of such a thing. Nobody knew. They could not find out what was the matter with this woman. And so through my inspiration and all, I knew there was nothing the matter with her. She just could not go through the process of bearing any more children. And my father was the last child, and he was 4 years old when she took to her bed, so he never had a mother. And he was a handsome, you saw his picture, a handsome man. All those boys were handsome. Three of them died of TB. Those were the days when everybody had TB. And they didn't know what to do about it. One boy was killed. He went off up north to a big, rock factory where they dug out rocks, and he got killed by one of the machines. And then my father became asthmatic and couldn't, for two or three years, never lay down at night in asthma. You can't sleep, you can't breathe. And he picked himself up and came to Colorado.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay.
That's how he got away. And in the end, he sent for his father. Then his mother died sometime later. And so he sent for his father, and the father rented a big box car and brought his live animals out in it, and all his fruit trees, branches of his fruit trees, and strawberry plants, and everything he had. By that time, they were living on a little farm. And everything he had, he brought out, and he started the big orchard on our dairy where we had all those trees. He planted all those trees and started them when he got to Colorado.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And he helped start the Congregational Church in Pueblo.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a very fine, elegant, cultured man. And I remember hearing my father say that they were having a terrible time with me. You see, I was a rebellious child. I didn't give in to things, and I was on a war path all the time, and they were having a bad time with me. And so he said to my father, "You're not handling that daughter. You're not handling that daughter correctly. And you're going to be in trouble with her." And my father said to his father, "Now this is my deal, not yours, and I'll have to do it my way." And so they just paid no attention to him. after about 6 years there, when I was 6 years old, he passed away. Mm-hmm. But my father was always very grateful to my mother because she was so good to him all mm-hmm. the time and took care of him until he passed away.
Now, Jesse, you talked a lot in some several of the tapes about your fear of childbirth. Now, do you have any idea where that fear came from, and what can you remember?
Yes,
what the feelings were?
Yes, I do, but I don't
were?
Like to tell it.
Oh, okay.
As a matter of fact, I had a baby by my father when mm-hmm. I was 10 years old, and the baby he took me to some hospital. I had sex relations with him a lot,
mm-hmm.
and I don't want to go into
okay.
that.
Okay. Okay.
But he took me to some place. I dreamed of it over and over again. And I had the baby, and the baby was a lovely baby, and I had it in the drawer, the chest of drawers. And one day when I woke up, it was gone. He took it away. I never knew what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that fear of childbirth was the mm-hmm. root of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now,
there's a lot of that going on still.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Incest is all over the place. I've had lots of people tell me stories of incest.
Now, since you were only 10 when your mother died, how did you, well, maybe this relates to the incest, how did you learn about menstruation? How did you learn about all of that?
Well, I was just 10 years old when she died, and after about 2 or 3 weeks, my father got Maud Finch to come take care of us, mm-hmm. who had been a seamstress for my mother, and who my mother always said that if she died, he was to get Maud Finch. She had been a school teacher. She was a very fine, intellectual woman. And so she came to take care of us and brought her mother with her. And after she'd been there a little while, then he suggested he marry her. He was very upset because he had to pay all this money for her upkeep. I guess he thought if he got married, it would be cheaper. And so she was in this, in the room where they slept, down near the kitchen, and talking about it. And I was outside listening at the door. I was a listener. Little girls often are, you know. And the mother said, well, the trouble is, she said, if you marry Ed, what you going to do with Jesse? And she said, oh, I'll take care of her all right. I can handle her. And she said, well, her mother said, her father can't stand her at all. And of course, the mother said, well, she said, I don't know how you're going to deal with her. Her father can't stand her, and how are you going to make it? Well, this is news to me, just having lost my mother. So I beat it upstairs and started to scream and yell and cry, went into complete hysterics, because obviously I had nobody, not even my father. And he was way out in the yard, barnyard, heard this awful screaming, and had his wife die and a little girl die 2 years before. He thought another tragedy, and he came tearing upstairs. And there I was, just screaming and yelling, and I had this penetrating voice, you could hear it a mile. And he...
You'll be there.
And he came in, and he knocked me out completely, you see. He was so frightened and scared. Mm. And so when I came to, I'd forgotten most of it, all of this.
Mm-hmm.
See? And now what was your question?
Well, who taught you about things like menstruation?
Oh, well, then, of course, this Maud Finch was there. And my brother and I did a lot of research on the origin of children and all that. I told you that.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to find out how the cows came mm-hmm. and everything. And so then the girls at school began talking about menstruation, and I didn't have any menstruation until I was 16 years old, and I was scared to death. There was something wrong with me.
Mm.
So evidently this experience I'd had with my maturing. It's amazing you can have a baby before you menstruate, but you can.
Mm.
There's a lot of evidence to that effect. And by that time I was talking about some of these personal things to the girls, and they were, have you started menstruating yet, and feeling very pleased that they were now menstruating, you know. And I have never, so I was 16 years old before I menstruated, so I was worried stiff that there was something physically wrong mm-hmm. with me, and I never could have a baby, see.
Was it? Did you understand about where babies came from and what menstruation was? You understood all that.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. See, I'm a Scorpio, partly a little bit. And Scorpios are sexual, and I had very great curiosity. I had that all down, black mm-hmm. and white. Besides that, the book that my mother had read on childbirth was in our library. And when I had this baby coming, and this woman was there then, she caught me in the reading that book. And that's probably where I got all the dope.
It was a
great big thick book, regular mm-hmm. woman's book. And so somebody came in and asked, what was I reading? And and she said with great humor, oh, she's trying to find out how to have babies. But she didn't know I had one coming. See?
Now this is this Maud Finch who was living there
yeah,
then?
Yeah, mm-hmm. she was then later married my father. Mm-hmm. And, well, it's a long story, a tragic story about that whole thing. I don't mm-hmm. think I
okay.
should go into it. No, it doesn't add anything to this.
Now, Jesse, tell me, when you first got married then, did you know anything about birth control?
Oh, Lord, yes. Mm-hmm. By that time, I'd been to Margaret Sanger's, all her lectures all over Boston. You know Margaret Sanger. Mm-hmm. Who started the birth control. I went to all her lectures and listened to the, oh yes, mm-hmm. I was 30 years old, 33. I had everything down cold. Got to England, Marie Stopes was the pioneer there, as Margaret Sanger was here, and she had birth control clinics, and I went to them at once.
Oh, now was this like a public clinic?
Oh yeah, well, yes, it was. I think one paid something, but then it was a well-publicized clinic, mm-hmm. and she lectured all the time on birth control, so now, anybody could go there, and I got instructions on what to do. You see, how to use the douche, mm-hmm. the douche, you know, and that's what everybody did then.
So that's what you used. Not you didn't use the pessary. Which is sort of like a diaphragm that they were using in England then.
I was very uneasy about that douche, I remember. But I don't remember that I had a pessary.
So what you recall was learning how to use the douche.
Oh, yes. They told you everything there mm-hmm. at that time. Now, I was 33, you know. I wasn't a little spring chicken. Then I'd been going... And the minute Margaret Sanger began lecturing in Boston and all over, I attended all her meetings, and because I was interested in it as a social issue mm-hmm. then, of course, because I wasn't married. But now when I got married in that big hotel, I don't think I used anything there. I didn't need to because my husband was a virgin too, and the sex act was very amateurish, you see.
Now, did he ever use anything, or you just used the douche?
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think he ever did.
Now, when you became pregnant with that miscarriage in England there, mm-hmm. Was that planned, or was that an accident?
I think I just didn't pay much attention. I think that's the way people do when they get married. They're careless, you know. And I got pregnant, and... within a year or so after I was married, and I seemed to be pleased. It was in the routine thing, and I did want a baby mm-hmm. very much. I wanted children more than a husband even, almost.
Now, how did they instruct you exactly about the use of the douche? Do you recall?
No, I don't recall mm-hmm. the details at all. That's funny. I just sort of took it. I don't know, it's a funny thing. It's so vital to your future that you'd be so casual about it. But I think most girls are. You know, they just take it as part of it, and so what, and they don't take it too seriously. Although I knew, I'm just wondering if I had one of those pessaries. What do the pessaries look like? Do you know?
They were around, they look a little bit like a diaphragm, but I think that instead of like a diaphragm, they were more like a cap. They were a round piece of rubber.
And you pushed them in.
And you pushed it in over the...
Sex. Mm-hmm. What'd you push them in over? The uterus?
Mm-hmm. Over the opening of the uterus.
Well, all those years, I must have had something. I think it was mostly the douche.
Now, do you recall what you used in the douche? did you use a special solution, vinegar just? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you were instructed to douche immediately after intercourse then?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was very careful about that, I remember. Then, of course, when I was 40 and had the uterus taken out, that was heaven. That's why I've forgotten all this, you see. I never
because then you didn't have to worry.
Yeah, that was really heaven after I was just 40. In that miscarriage, my uterus was torn to bits with this childbirth because it came feet first, that baby did. And I was all torn up. I don't know how I've been after that, but it was in bad shape.
Well, did you have the hysterectomy right after your son was born then?
Soon after, fairly soon, because I got started bleeding a lot. And the doctor examined me, and he said the uterus was torn, and it was not infected with cancer or anything, but it was just torn to bits, and they had to get it out. So I was delighted, of course, once I got rid of the uterus. I never had any menopause or anything, no hot flashes, no nothing. I had it taken out, and then we had our little hideout up in the Shenandoah Mountains, and I immediately went up there and spent the whole summer sleeping and resting and doing no work. It was heaven.
So you weren't upset by it at all? A lot of women very often
No. Well, they left in the ovaries, mm-hmm. the man did. And also, that he was one of the first men in Washington to perform that operation without cutting your tummy open. He performed it from below, and so I was not... The stomach was never opened up. They used to always open it up to take it out, but he didn't.
Now that would have been...
He was one of the first men that knew how to do that operation, get that uterus out without an incision in the body.
Now, Jesse, in the early days, see, right after you were married, what was it like to go to a gynecologist then? First of all, were they men or women usually? Do you recall?
Oh, I hunted up the women in mm-hmm. England right away. I wouldn't go to a man at all. And I was so enthusiastic and gay and happy, so I threw her off the track. And she examined me when I got pregnant, and I immediately hunted up this woman in the Foxhall Village where we live in the Hampstead Garden suburb. And then after when I was nearly 7 months along, I went and got examined again and see if I could go on this weekend holiday down on the Isle of Wight. And she did not test my urine, or she would have found out that I had albumin in that urine. I looked well and was gay, and so she said, go ahead. And I got down to Isle of Wight, I started to turn green. All my legs went green and everything. It was, I told you about that.
Mm-hmm.
It was by the grace of God midwife was down there for the weekend, and this doctor, he didn't know what to do.
So you first called in a doctor, though?
Yeah, we called a doctor, and I was beginning to have these terrible pains at the foot of my brain, and he told my husband I'd go out of my mind by morning and that I'd be dead by the middle of next day. And if I'd been in the Rocky Mountains, I couldn't have found an antiquated doctor.
Now, must have known you were pregnant, didn't he?
Oh, yes. Well, he said that the baby was dead, he told my husband, and that I had this albumin poisoning, and I was going to go out of my mind and die by next morning.
He didn't consider any surgery then?
No, he didn't want to be mixed up with it at all. This English and American embassy and all. And so on the way out of the hospital, this woman was coming in the door. And he said, how'd she happen to be there? Well, she'd left there, but she came back for the weekend for the Easter holiday. And he said, well, there's a woman awfully sick upstairs. You better go up and look at her. And all of a sudden the door opened, and she stuck her head in the door, and she said, what's going on here? And I said, I'm in terrible trouble. My legs were all green, turned green.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody says, the grace of God, I didn't die because I was so badly poisoned, because the baby had been dead 2 weeks. And the reason the baby was dead was that I went to this doctor after I got pregnant, and I went to him too just before we went to the Isle of Wight, and he said, you oughtn't to be having a baby, your marriage is not established, you'll never make that marriage go, and he killed that baby.
Now this was a man.
At that interview, mm-hmm. yeah. He did something, he said something that so discouraged me, I think that baby died there. I've always thought it died there. So it had been dead 2 weeks when I got
down
there.
Well, Jesse, when you went to see the doctor before you went to the Isle of Wight...
That was the woman doctor.
That was the woman doctor.
Yeah.
But did she examine your uterus at all?
No, I don't think she did.
She just talked
to
you.
And she didn't test the urine, which was very careless of her. I went back and told her, too, what had happened. I made a point of that.
Now, and the only time during
then,
the course...
Doctor said, she said, what's going on here? And I said, oh, I'm in terrible trouble, and told her that I was 7 months along, and she looked at my legs and everything, and I had this pounding at the foot of my brain, which goes on with that poisoning and puts you out of your mind. You go crazy. And she said, now look, dearie, she said, you just keep your shirt on. I've brought 150 babies into the world last year, and I guess I know how to take care of you. And I said, oh, my God. You're one of those Florence Nightingale midwives. Oh, yes. Well, of course, I just calmed right down. Pretty soon, Hugh came in. She said, now, you go to bed. We're going to handle this ourselves. We're going to take care of it. And so then she came back, and she said, well, what have you got here? And I said, nothing. I've just come down for the weekend, the Easter weekend. So she went downstairs and got some big rolls of paper, wrapping paper, and all it was a great big bowl that you washed your hands and face in there, you know, in a regular old-fashioned toilet and bedroom. And she stripped around, she examined me, and she said, yes, the birth of the baby had started.
Now, she examined your uterus
all
this time. She did a regular pelvic.
Yeah, she did a pelvic test, and she said that it had started. The birth pangs were on. And I got worse and worse with this pain in my head. But what she did, she started talking to me and told me what was going on. And she kept my mind off my... I never saw anything like it. And of course, I've got such curiosity, it's easy to get me interested, you see. And then about 2 o'clock, I said, how much longer is this going to be? And she said, oh, it'll be 2 more hours. And I said, okay, dear, you go over there now and lie down and sleep. I said, there's nothing... Nobody can start. She didn't give me anything, a pain reliever or anything. If she, out here, they'd have given you a drug, you know, let you go to sleep or something. And not her. She just went over and I said, you go over there and lie down now and have a sleep. And she did. And when she woke up, came over, while the baby was almost there. And feet first, you see, which is very bad. Then she talked to me so much that of course, I never had a baby that I consciously knew about. And I was so interested that it counteracted what's going on in my head, which was almost unendurable. But she said she knew the minute she saw me, I'd never lose my mind. She knew that right away. And when the baby came, I never saw it. She said, been dead 2 weeks.
Now, was this all in the hospital, or was this in your hotel
room? No, right in this hotel room. And she never got a spot on the sheet or anything. Handled it all with this one big... You know, she'd been in all these poverty homes, you see. And she said the baby was a girl, a little girl, with black hair. And she said, I just felt terrible because I had eaten so badly all those months. I hadn't done the right things, but nobody told me how to. I didn't know anything about having a baby.
Well, Jesse, when you went to the first doctor, was the first doctor you went to was the man?
No, I never went to a man.
Oh.
I went to that woman doctor right away.
Now, did
and I got pregnant.
And did she, do you remember, did she give you regular pelvics? Or
I don't remember that she did. No, she may have done it. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what was going on hardly, and I don't remember that I got a pelvic. It seems as though she would have done something, but she was careless, all right. I went back and made a point of going back and telling her what happened.
And then now after you had this
baby... Did I tell you how I got over it, about the woman that came and talked to me on the bench?
On the bench, Now after you
had... Never stopped crying right away. It healed me. That really got me going, interested in women's, what it did. Okay.
Now after you had that baby, you continued to use the douche again? You were going to wait a while then?
Some. I went to my big doctor in London. And I said, do you think I can ever have a baby? And he said, yes, but you're in very bad condition from this poisoning. And then I had rheumatism from head to foot, just terrible in this awful climate.
Oh, and that's when you went to
Germany
then?
That's when I went to Baden-Baden.
I see. Mm-hmm. So during that time, though,
I got my body fixed up.
So you were going to wait a while, though, till you got pregnant again.
Well, my daughter was born 24. You see, 2 years I waited. Mm-hmm. He told me to wait 2 years.
And then during that time period, what you just remember still using the douche during that time, 2 years?
Oh, yes. I was very careful about that douche. I certainly didn't want to get pregnant till I was fit to do it. And I've got a vague feeling about those pessaries, but not too clear.
Mm-hmm.
I think I tried to get my husband to wear something, but he hated it so.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think I could trust him anyway, not because he wanted to, but he was careless, you know. But the funny thing, I want to tell you a funny thing. Now, this is another psychological thing that you can't put down. But according to people who are authorities on metaphysics and reincarnation, the souls try to find the family they want to get born in where they can get for the help they need in a new life, you see, and where their karma can be lifted and so on. And my daughter, there was a woman that wrote metaphysical books in England, and I've got one of her books in my library. She wrote a lot of, she was a good writer. She wrote a lot of cheap dime novels. And then all of a sudden, she started writing metaphysical books, real beautiful writings they were. And I've got one of her books in my library, and I haven't seen it lately, but unless I've loaned it to somebody. And so I read some of her books then, when I was there. And I got the feeling that Hugh was absolutely against our having any children. He said, I knew we weren't up to it. I knew we weren't equipped to have children. He was right. He wasn't equipped for it, neither was I, with this early that I've just been telling you about, you know. And in a way, we'd have been better not to have tried to have children, really. We would have. We took our lives in our hands, as badly equipped as we were. And so anyway, this woman had determined to come into our family. That's my daughter. I don't want this down.
Okay.
I don't want to. I haven't got that turned on.
Okay. When you then became pregnant with her, you immediately went to the mother's clinic? Or did you go to just a doctor?
With my daughter, mm-hmm. You mean. Oh, no. By this time, I knew the mother's clinics were all over the place, and there was a big one in London, one of the biggest. But I went to that clinic forever I got pregnant.
Oh.
I used to go because as a student of what was going on, aside from my own personal interest, I wanted to see how they handled those clinics. I don't know whether I've told you about that big clinic.
Yeah, we talked about that.
And I sat there for our days, for weeks.
Oh, so that was before you even...
Oh, yes, so that I learned, I got into the atmosphere of the child care and all the things that are involved, instead of being in an atmosphere of lobbying at the Capitol, for instance. It's another world, you see, and all the women came in there with their babies. I talked to and I saw how the doctor handled them. And at that time, I still didn't have a baby coming, but I was very excited over it as a study for women, which has been my goal all my life.
Now, were the doctors there women doctors at these mother's clinics?
No. They were all men doctors, but the people who ran the mother's clinics in the little villages were all midwives, all women. Those clinics, of course, were just open like a store is every day. And every woman in the whole village, the whole country around the village, drifted in there all day long. Before they got pregnant, right after they were married, to find out what they should do to have babies, and they went in there and started getting educated. And then those mother's clinics in the little towns all through the week would have an afternoon when somebody from London would come down and lecture on some aspect of child care, and then they'd all have a cup of tea and a little cookie.
But usually...
They made a science of child care, and why not? You make a science of going to the moon, don't you? Well, this is much more intricate than going to the moon to give birth to little babies to bring new human beings in the world. What could be a greater science?
Now, Jesse, when you told me about this before, you said that you'd go into the hospital and stay a month after the birth of the child.
I went to I went to the women's club in London that I had helped them to get going, really. And Mrs. Curtis Brown finally bought the great big beautiful building that I told you about. So I began talking around there to the American women. Where do you go when I turn off and close this door?
Okay.
The women's club, of course, all the time, and was lecturing there on current events and everything. And so I asked everybody, you know, where do you go when you get pregnant? And they said, oh, one woman, particularly alert, keen woman, said, there is a doctor who has a nursery down in Blackheath for childbirth, and he's ultra-modern. He makes every woman that comes in there breastfeeds their own babies, and he has all the modern rules about the birth of children and everything. And his name is Dr. Pink, and his assistant is Dr. White. So Pink and White have been running this nursery down there, nursing home, they've had 400 babies there already. And they're very proud of themselves. Only one woman got out of there who wasn't breastfeeding her baby. So I got his name immediately and called up and went down there and had an interview with him. And I was just thrilled. It was a beautiful old home. It had been a private home with an enormous garden. And he said, we like to have the mothers come here before the children are born. And we call them ladies in waiting. And they come here and they get rested and they get into the atmosphere of childbirth and they get over being scared and they begin to think of it as a very natural process. And I said, but isn't that expensive? And he said, oh no, all you have to pay is just boarding, what you would pay in a boarding house. And so anyway, we like to have that. And I said, well, I've just had this terrible experience. And I said, you think I can really have another baby? And he said, well, he said, I'm not going to let you spoil my record, I'll tell you that. So if you come here, you'll have the baby all right. And so he gave me some instructions and everything, and then had me come down every now and then and be examined to see how everything was going. And in the end, though, I didn't go to that nursery home beforehand with my daughter because she started coming and I didn't have time to get down there. And I had to be driven down there the night that she started coming.
Well, was she early then?
No, she was at the time, but I don't know. I didn't why I didn't get there, but anyway, I didn't with my boy. I was there for 2 weeks before he came.
Before he was born.
That was a really great experience. We used to play bridge every evening, and we talked, everything, and then every morning somebody would come into the bedroom and say, well, we got a new baby here last night. And I would say, oh, how did the mother get along? Just fine. Everything went so well. And she apologized to the doctor for keeping him up at night. Well, I said, I'm not going to apologize to anybody. I'm going to have somebody there all the time. And then they'd bring in the new baby, you see, till you were just in this baby atmosphere. It was divine. There was so much love. And this man, Dr. Pink, was a theosophist. He was had all of Annie Besant's books here, and I read them all when I was, and he made us stay nearly a month.
After the
baby was born, until you got thoroughly rested, made us take exercises to get our bodies back in shape, and the great thing was they got the babies trained to sleep all night. So you went home with a highly trained baby, breastfeeding going like clockwork, and a baby that slept all night. And once a child learns to sleep all night, they become good night sleepers for life. That's when they form the first habit of sleep. It's a wonderful thing. So it was, it was just lovely. And I remember when I got home with my baby, my husband had been ordered to go to France for 2 weeks for the United States by the American Embassy, for the United States Department of Commerce to do something for them. And he said, oh, it's just a shame. I wish I could take you along so you could get a holiday. And I said, I've had a holiday. I don't need any more. I've had a gorgeous time. Had nothing to do but just be waited on, taken care of, and petted and humored and taught. And I said, I've had a lark, so I don't need to go to France for a holiday. And he was so astonished, he didn't know what to do. And it's a great contrast to what happens to the women in this country. I've heard some very bad tales on what happens. And the interesting thing is, there's a woman in now in Pomona who is one of those midwives. And for several years, many years, she had a bicycle. She used to deliver 150 babies a year. And as I've said before, it's the cheapest thing. My month at that place was only $82 for the whole birth of that child. Imagine
now,
that.
Did the midwife deliver the baby or the doctor?
Oh, yes, the midwives all deliver the babies. They've all been taught to deliver babies. She just gets on her bicycle and is summoned to come
no,
to
No, where you
home.
Went, though? Did the midwife deliver
the
doctor?
Oh, yes, the doctor delivered the baby.
And then,
it was a long delivery, too. It lasted all night.
And were you given anything?
Or? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you were not conscious during the delivery?
No, I wasn't. Yeah.
Now, how did you feel about the male doctors? Would you have preferred a woman doctor?
Well, of course, I just automatically went to a woman doctor, but having had that bad experience, also, I did feel I was in the hands of a very great expert, and his nurses were experts, too. So I felt much more comfortable with that man in charge. Mm-hmm. I felt it was a much better deal, really.
Now, Jesse, did you then start, after you had your daughter, then did you go to the mother's clinics, or did you continue to go to this Dr. Pink?
Well, I went to him some, of course, and as soon as I got pregnant again, I did want another child. I didn't want to just bring up an only child. And as soon as I got pregnant again, I went down there, and everything was perfect. And then he had me come and stay before the boy came. And I'll never forget that, because it was so beautiful. And so much, of course, was easy, because having been through it, it made everything much more attractive and easy and so on. Although I did have a very bad experience with the birth. Just as the boy was about there, another baby came in, another woman came in, and her baby was almost there, had almost up there on the right end. So they had to move me out of that warm room where I was into a cold bedroom, and it delayed the whole birth 6 hours, frightened me, and I got scared. But there wasn't anything they could do. The other baby was practically there, and they had to take the care of that woman. And so he had a bad birth, and in the end they had to use forceps.
Mm.
And his head was all misshapen and so on. I've always felt awful badly about that. But it upset me so. I was so cold, and the baby was practically there, and then suddenly he wasn't there. And
did someone stay with you when they put you in this other room?
Oh, yes, they did. But it was just one of those things that can happen every time. And I had something in there that I was going to tell you, and it slipped my mind what something else that happened that was interesting. One thing, of course, was the way they got those children to sleep all night.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you told me that earlier.
And I know what it was, about my milk. Did I tell you about my breasts? What a bad time I had with my breasts. I have to feed this baby. Well, I happened to have very small breasts, and I was very worried, you see. And he said, oh, Mrs. Butler, those are the best breasts there are. The big, heavy breasts, the milk has to plow through all that fat to get to the baby. And he said, they're good. And he said, you know, another thing you have that's absolutely priceless. And I said, what? I needed to know if I had anything that was any good. I had what they call strawberry nipples. They're very large nipples, the shape of a strawberry. And he had me, for the last 3 months before she came, scrub those nipples every night with a tough toothbrush to harden them up. Now, this is something that no American women are taught at all. The result is the nipples are very soft and sensitive, and if the baby is a tough sucker, the nipples split and get sore, and then the doctor suddenly withdraws the baby from the milk. And that's where a lot of psychological problems hit children, when they can't get their milk anymore from their mother.
Now, was it painful to do this scrubbing, though?
Oh, no, of course not. I mean, at first they were sensitive, you know, but as you scrub them every night, they began to toughen up. So I had marvelous nipples. In addition to that, when they started nursing the baby, the baby was supposed to get 24 ounces of milk a day, and I was only producing 19 ounces. And I said, there you are, doctor, you see? And I was just sure, what could they do about that? And he said, don't you worry about that. You'll be producing enough milk. in no time. And he told me how the milk machinery is under the arm, which I didn't know. And so they started in for two or three days, twice a day, bathing the breasts, first in hot water and then in cold, to stimulate the blood circulation, you see, because I was a little anemic anyway. And then they massaged the breast from under the arm out very gently. And within 4 days, instead of producing 24 ounces a day, and I was producing 19, in 4 days I was producing 35 ounces a day. Also, they had you drink water as you were nursing. They did not give you cow's milk, as the doctors do in this country, to increase the milk supply. Cow's milk is made for cows, not babies. And it's full of heavy protein that makes a woman get fat. And it doesn't do any good for the baby's milk. But while you're nursing the baby, they give you a glass of water. It runs right down into the milk factory and turns into milk on the way. And so I had plenty of milk after that for my baby. Mm. And the final thing they did, when you didn't nurse the baby at night, you nursed the baby at 11 at night and then again at 5 in the morning, your breasts were so full of milk, having missed one feed, and the baby couldn't, it wasn't wise to let the baby overeat because then they got sick. So she taught me how to draw that milk off, put it into a bottle, and cap the bottle, and put it in the